will turn, I should also say, I'm sorry I omitted, that Tom Jackson is here from Senator Dale Schultz's office, a meeting with the students. We'll now turn to calling our second case, 98-2387 CR, State versus Beach. Daniel Bryan, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, represents the State of Wisconsin. Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This case is before the Court on the State's petition to review a decision of the Court of Appeals, District 4, and on Mr. Veach's cross-petition to review that same decision. In the case of State v. Wallerman, a 1996 decision, the Court of Appeals created a rule of evidence which bars other acts' evidence from a criminal trial if the defendant is willing to concede the mental state, or in the legal terminology, mens rea, elements of an offense, yet remain free to challenge the act itself, the occurrence of the act itself, or the actus reus element of the offense. In 1998, the Court of Appeals, in a case named State v. DeKeyser, extended that rule one step further. It held that a trial attorney is ineffective if he fails to rely on the Wallerman rule of evidence to keep out the other act's evidence if the client, the defendant, testifies at a post-conviction hearing that he would have been willing to concede the mens rea or mental state elements while remaining free to challenge proof of whether the act itself occurred. Finally, in this case, the third in the trilogy that we are challenging, State v. Veach, the Court of Appeals took those two prior decisions to their logical conclusion and held that an attorney was ineffective for failing to rely on the Wallerman rule of evidence because his client testified that he would have been willing to concede the mental state evidence elements. That is so even though the Court of Appeals held and the trial court held that the evidence was properly admissible, was relevant, and was not overly prejudicial, and even though there's no dispute that Mr. Veach received a fair trial with a reliable result. The state submits that this trilogy of cases unnecessarily intrudes on the role of the prosecutor, the defense attorney, the trial judge, and the jury. It unnecessarily and unreasonably intrudes on the prosecutor's discretionary decision just precisely how he or she intends to prove the state's case beyond a reasonable doubt, and unnecessarily and unreasonably intrudes on the strategic choices made by a defendant and defense counsel, and unnecessarily and unreasonably intrudes on the trial judge's exercise of discretion whether or not to admit other acts evidence or any other evidence for that matter, and finally, it intrudes on the fact-finding function of the jury by taking away from its search for the truth, relevant, probative, and non-prejudicial evidence. The state submits that it is time for this court to return some sense of rationality and logic to the rules of evidence and overrule this trilogy of cases. The state submits that the 1996 Wallerman decision and the 1998 DeKeyser decision, and accordingly this decision in this case, do not survive decisions of this court both before and after the DeKeyser decision. We have the 2000 decisions in State v. Davidson and State v. Hammer, which state in crystal clear terms that the defense cannot dictate how the prosecutor proves its case. Simply because the defense says it is not disputing a certain point does not mean that it can bar the admission of evidence. And that is not a new idea. That was held by this court in a 1997 decision, State v. Alexander, which followed the United States Supreme Court's 1997 decision in Old Chief v. United States. All nine U.S. Supreme Court justices agreed in Old Chief that the defense cannot dictate how the prosecution proves its case. It's simply because the defense does not dispute a point does not mean that the state is barred from introducing the relevant evidence. The split in that case came only on the question of that narrow situation where the defendant's status, his status as a convicted felon, is an element of offense, and that status is not in dispute, whether the state can be forced to enter into a stipulation. And I use the word stipulation guardedly. What I'd also point out in the Alexander decision, which followed Old Chief to the letter, this court held 7-0 that the defense cannot dictate how the prosecution proves its case. And I use the word stipulation guardedly because it's a misnomer. In Wallerman, when the court talks about a stipulation, there's nothing stipulated here. Stipulation entails an agreement between the parties. Obviously, if there was an agreement, the state wouldn't be here on a petition for review. And obviously, in most cases where a defendant denies that the act occurred, the state is going to be unlikely to agree to keep out of the case. In many cases, it's most probative evidence.
Counsel, I want to focus just on that. The question that arises in my mind is whether or not the language, for instance, in Davidson that says the defendant does not dispute, if does not dispute is the same as stipulate, or is the same as you would indicate, a formal agreement of facts, that which is encompassed in our current jury instruction 162, agreed facts. Seems to me there's a difference between does not dispute and what we might use the term a formal stipulation. Isn't there?
Well, in this context, I don't see what the difference is, because obviously this sort of a stipulation assumes that there's no dispute as to the factual question or the element.
The difference is, let me illustrate the difference as though I were a civil trial attorney dealing with, let's say, medical records. And I'm a defense attorney, and the plaintiff wants to prove up medical records, and I know that they're right as a defense attorney, and I really have nothing to say, so I don't object, I don't even try to raise a defense, but I don't stipulate to their admissibility, because by not objecting, I still require to put the plaintiff to their proof thereon. So isn't there a legal difference and significance between the words does not object to and stipulation, a formal stipulation as envisioned in jury instruction 162, formal agreed facts? Because in a stipulation and or agreed facts, the trial court instructs the jury, you must accept these facts as conclusively proven.
Right.
Yeah, so
and there is a difference. However, the difference, I don't think that there's a difference with respect to the impact of Davidson and Hammer on the DeKeyser decision. The Court of Appeals recognized, openly acknowledged in its decision, that Davidson overruled DeKeyser on the point that the prosecution is not prevented from introducing relevant evidence simply because the defendant does not dispute the point. Well, I think it logically follows that if that is the case, then the state cannot be forced to enter into a formal stipulation on these supposedly undisputed points if the state does not choose to do so. So obviously there's a distinction between a formal stipulation and just not contesting something in a trial. But again, as far as the impact of this court's decisions in Davidson and Hammer on the DeKeyser decision, I think the result is the same. And therefore, I think the Court of Appeals made a mistake in not taking the next logical step once it acknowledged that DeKeyser had been overruled on the one point in saying, therefore, it necessarily follows that the formal stipulation based on these supposed undisputed facts is no longer a valid principle of law. And so that's a long answer to your question, I guess. But
so what does the state want this opinion to say in the paragraph that say, we hold that, we conclude that, as a rule of law?
We conclude that the forced conditional stipulation is not a valid rule of law. We hold from henceforth that the appropriate test to be applied in assessing the admissibility of other acts evidence is the test adopted by this court in State v. Sullivan and followed in State v. Davidson and Hammer, the three-part test for assessing relevance, probative admissibility, relevance, and balancing probative value against potential for prejudice. And in a case involving the sexual assault of a child, that Sullivan, three-part Sullivan test is to be illuminated by the greater latitude rule, which, in closed cases, allows for greater admissibility of other acts evidence because of the unique nature of child sexual assault cases.
If an issue is not in dispute, then when you get to the weighing and the balancing, don't you have to come out that it's more prejudicial than probative?
If an issue is not in dispute,
yeah,
yes.
Like intent, for example. There's no dispute that that if there was a touching, the intent is sexual gratification.
Well, and I guess that gets to the heart of our argument,
yeah,
which is
I think you come out the other, whether you do it on the front end or you do it at the back end, you ought to get rid of this evidence. If it's not in dispute, it's highly prejudicial because it's appeals to the emotions of the people, right? I mean, isn't that what makes it prejudicial?
If it's not in dispute, but that begs the question whether intent.
Okay, well, we're going to get to
dispute.
Whether it's in dispute. All right. Okay. So now we get to what's the issue in dispute here to which this other act's evidence relates? What's the issue?
Well, as the trial court held, there were three issues. There could have been more, but we'll just rely on what the trial court held.
Okay.
Motive.
All right, but the
intent.
Why is that in dispute?
Why is that in dispute?
Yeah, the defendant agrees that if he had touched or if there had been a touching by somebody, it was sexual gratification.
Yeah, well, the word if is two letters long, but it's a very large word. It's a condition. It's a condition put on the admission that undercuts the validity of the stipulation. He is, in essence, saying, I intended to commit an act that I didn't do. I was motivated to commit an act that I didn't do. That makes no sense. How can a rational juror evaluate that stipulation? What is a juror to do with that? That sort of a stipulation, with its condition, allows the defense, as it did in this case, to challenge, both in evidence and in argument to the jury, that this child is not to be believed about anything she said in court. And if you look at the cross-examination, if you look at the defense case, unfortunately, we don't have the arguments of counsel in this record, which complicates exactly how this evidence was used, although we know from the trial judge's finding that it wasn't used much in closing argument.
So you want to put this evidence in to bolster her testimony?
Well, to bolster her testimony on these disputed points, on not only the state of mind, but whether the act...
It's not disputed, counsel.
I'm sorry?
Motive, intent, absence of mistake, that's not disputed.
But it is disputed. Let's put it this way. I guess that brings me to a point, I would like, when defense counsel gets up here, I would like you to explain exactly what the stipulation, how the stipulation would read, what the jury instructions would be, what sort of a verdict form would be submitted to the jury, and how the prosecutor could argue the case. In counsel's brief, there's repeated statements that These are undisputed. These are to be conclusively proven. There's no challenge. This is just an alternative form of proving an undisputed point. If that's true, then I want the defense to put their money where the mouth is. I assume that that allows the prosecutor then to get up in front of the jury and say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, Mr. Veach concedes that he intended to touch Becky, and
had
he was sexually... Had
he touched
Becky? No. I think it's a valid argument. If you're going to say this is truly not in dispute, I think it's perfectly proper for the prosecutor to say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, Mr. Veach concedes that he was motivated to touch Becky for purposes of sexual gratification. However, he denies that he, in fact, did touch her. Therefore, it is our burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt whether or not he touched her.
Okay.
Because if they're not willing to go that far, then they're still disputing state of mind.
All right, let's just take that. They're willing to go that far. Can you bring in this other act's evidence?
I would suggest that at that point, probably not, if it's not probative of anything else in dispute. That because the other act evidence, if it is only admissible to prove state of mind, motive, and intent, if he's willing to admit that he had that state of mind, that yes, I was motivated to touch her, and I actually even took steps to do it, but it didn't happen. I never did it. She's imagining it or something. But he's got to make... See, they put the cart before the horse. They're saying, well, if I touched her, then I had the state of mind. No, it's... I had the state of mind, but I didn't touch her. And that's a big difference. And that takes the conditional aspect out of it. That is the rare situation where you might... But where you might very well bar the other act's evidence, because now the jury knows conclusively, beyond a reasonable doubt, that yes, this defendant intended to do the act, and the only issue in dispute is whether the act occurred. I mean, now that sort of, that creates problems too. Now you're almost asking for a special verdict, because now you're basically submitting only one verdict to the jury. Did the defendant touch Becky L?
He's not admitting that he intended to do the act. It seems to me that the defendant is admitting that if, in fact, the act was done, it was done for the purpose of sexual gratification. And what he's saying is I didn't do it. I didn't touch her.
I didn't do it. Why? Because I didn't have a state of mind? Because I had a state of mind, but I didn't touch her? That's not clear.
I wasn't there. I was in New York.
Fine. That cuts right into the teeth of these federal cases where you're talking about hypothetical persons not on trial. Someone did it, but it wasn't me. Let's put this imaginary person on trial. No, you are on trial. What are you admitting? What did you do? What did you think? How did you act? What are you willing to admit with respect to this particular offense, this particular victim, your particular conduct? And if you're not willing to admit anything, if you're going to condition it, if you're going to raise hypothetical stipulations about people not on trial, in the words of the Seventh Circuit and Fourth Circuit, you're not really stipulating anything, because credibility, her general credibility is still an issue, his general credibility is still an issue on all points.
So you think because this evidence can go in to support her credibility?
Yes.
And that's the point of this evidence, isn't it? To undermine his credibility, I didn't do it. Because you've done it before, you probably did it now. And to bolster her credibility, he's done it before, she's probably telling the truth.
Well, it bolsters the credibility, well, in this court, going back to 1898, says that that's a proper use of this evidence, because the issue in dispute, assuming you can enter assuming you can invoke this conditional rule barring other acts evidence on the question of mens rea, the threshold question of whether the act occurred is still in dispute. She's saying it occurred. This tends to support her credibility on the threshold act of was there a touching, which is obviously an essential element of the crime charged. And it also tends to bolster her credibility on state of mind, which is, in this case, inextricably tied up with the act of touching.
Why don't
Obviously,
you?
There's there was some sort of touching here, and the question is, what was he doing? What was he thinking? What was his motive? And so these are inextricably tied up. It bolsters her credibility on all of these points.
Wouldn't a better rule just be that we have a charge of a sexual contact or intercourse with a child, that any prior acts, you can even say similar, put that in, of a defendant relating to sexual activity with a child is admissible on credibility, for credibility purposes?
Well, a lot of jurisdictions have done precisely that.
I don't think you need... And then we just got get rid of all of this. We've got... How many cases have we had on other acts evidence with children?
Well, believe me, you'll have many more if you affirm. But that's besides the point. I think many jurisdictions have adopted that rule, but you don't have to go that far.
We're not... Why don't go that far instead of fooling around with this? Because it doesn't fit intent.
Well, I'll give you an example. The federal courts, the U.S. Congress passed just such a law that basically you can use other acts evidence strictly to prove propensity to commit a sex act. But the federal courts interpreting that have all upheld that law, but they all have said that it does not violate due process because it's still subject to the 90403 or the federal rule 403 balancing test. There still has to be some connection to the case. You know, it can't just be he's a bad guy or even he's a pedophile. You've got to prove specific acts. You've got to tie them in somehow to the case. So you still have to satisfy that balancing test, and that's the check and balance on an otherwise very broad rule. And I think this court, as I said, doesn't need to go that far because we have what I think the test of time has proven is a good test, the three-part Sullivan test, and a good rule in child sexual assault cases called the greater latitude rule, which counsels those three steps in the Sullivan analysis.
Why, Mr. O'Brien, you know, I'm quite persuaded that that might well be the better rule. But as a justice up here, I've got to support the statute until the legislature does otherwise. It seems to me that this is a very easy sell to the legislature. Why don't you sell it to the legislature and get them to change that statute that says you can only do it for certain purposes?
Well, I don't think it's necessary. As I just said, this court has an analytical framework. I'm sorry?
Bring a rule change to this court. This is a rule, not a statute, right?
You know, as we discussed earlier, there may be cases where the other acts evidence doesn't come in on a truly undisputed point. And I don't know that that's, you know, I think under the existing rules, the decision of the Court of Appeals here doesn't stand up. I don't think we need to ask this court to change any rules or to go to the legislature. I think that the consistent body of this case law, going back to the proper decision, and admittedly, a lot of these are very narrowly decided cases, very narrow votes in the cases, but consistently, this court has allowed for greater admissibility of other acts evidence in child sexual assault cases. There's no need to go to the legislature. Obviously, the state still has to satisfy the Sullivan test. And if the points are truly not in dispute, not conditionally not in dispute, but truly not in dispute, such as status in the old Chief and Alexander situation, or the case where the defendant is willing to admit that he was sexually attracted to the daughter, then the other acts evidence probably doesn't come in. But in other than those situations, it's entirely in the discretion of the judge. And that's really, we're just talking about what is a proper exercise of discretion for a trial judge to make, what factors to be considered in deciding whether certain evidence is admissible. That's all it boils down to. That's the function of this court, not the function of the legislature, in assessing whether a judge properly exercised discretion. I don't think we need a meat cleaver approach such as the federal courts did, or such as the U.S. Congress did, because I think that the body of case law that we have here is sufficient to allow a judge in the exercise of discretion to, yes, allow this in most child sexual assault cases, but not all, and that there still has to be a connection in terms of time, place, and circumstance.
Okay, what's the connection here?
Here we have the prior act, which occurred roughly 11 years before the charged act. The prior victim was 9, the present victim was 7. The prior victim was the defendant's daughter. Becky was a child with whom the defendant developed a close relationship, which was described as akin to a father-daughter relationship. There's proof the defendant had been drinking on both occasions. The defendant actually tied these incidents together when he testified, when he told the police officer after giving a statement, "I can't believe this is happening to me again. This is why I left home in 1987, because I was having problems with my daughter." And of course, the defense will say, "Well, yeah, but there's 11 years separating." The case law supports the notion that that is not in and of itself determinative. And in any event, that if Mr. Veach was convicted of one of the prior incidents, that presumably, and I don't have the judgment of conviction in front of me, presumably he was in custody and or on paper for most of that 10-year period, or the 7-year period between his 1987 conviction and his 1994 act. And therefore, that shrinks the time.
I think that, as I recall, he got a year in jail and 5 years probation.
Yeah, so the probation ends then in 93. This act occurred in 94. So I think that allows a trial judge in the exercise of discretion to say, boy, especially this relationship of trust and the age and the indisputably sexual nature of the prior act, which is highly probative of whether the defendant was motivated to seek sexual gratification when he touched Becky in the hammock and in the sleeping bag in his van. And as far as the exercise of discretion here, I think the Court of Appeals was absolutely correct and thorough in its analysis of the trial judge's correct and thorough analysis of the relevant factors and the application of the Sullivan test here, and that decision should not be disturbed. I see my light is on, so I'll conclude. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Suzanne Hagopian from the Frank Remington Center at the University of Wisconsin, representing Mr. Veach.
May it please the Court, my name is Suzanne Hagopian and I represent Michael Veach. Well, the state has launched quite an attack on the sort of stipulations sanctioned in Wallerman and DeKaiser in this case, but there's nothing radical about those decisions. They rest on a basic and reasonable principle, which is this. The state may not use other acts evidence to prove an element it doesn't have to prove. And the state doesn't have to prove the element when the defendant is willing to admit it through a formal stipulation.
Now, the state indicates that, going back to Wallerman, which is a 1996 case, that it's made up and these are their words, whole cloth. In other words, where does the Wallerman stipulation come from?
Well, Wallerman relied on, cited several federal circuit court cases, and one of those was, I believe, from the First Circuit, and picked up really sort of this idea that a stipulation would bar the admission of other acts evidence.
Right. Then they went, this is 96, then the 98. They said, now if you fail, of course, we're talking about trial here that took place in 97. We're talking about the Veach case that we're talking about. But then in 98, they said that if you fail to use the stipulation, then you are, per se, you're got the counsel, in other words, you, and of course, you counseled your fail to use that. Seems to me that at least DeKaiser itself, which is the prodigy of Wallerman, substantially undercuts or may undercut the cases that came out of this court, Davidson and Hammer. And I think that is what the counsel's brief indicates, that having said that there is a greater latitude, that you follow the three steps of Sullivan. But how can you force the state to follow what the prosecutor, in other words, this is a conditional stipulation, but it forces the state to adjust their attack as far as how they're going to present their case. How can you do that?
All right. If I could begin by answering by just one point, saying I disagree with the construction of de Keyser as a per se ineffectiveness. I think this is going to depend on the particular facts of the case, and lawyers may have valid strategy reasons for not entering into a stipulation. But to set that aside for a moment and go more directly to your question, you know, I think there is very little conditional about these stipulations. As Justice Bradley highlighted, we're talking about a stipulation that removes the state's obligation to present any evidence on that element. So it's like an admission. That's how the court described it in Alexander. An old chief says it's conclusive proof of the element. And indeed, that's how the court would instruct the jury. So,
but in this case and in others, he's free. He, the defendant, is free to argue.
I can't understand. I'm sorry. I'm having a hard time, Jeff.
We have problems with our audio system.
Frankly,
and we're having trouble hearing Justice Booker.
Speaking. I can speak louder. I'll just forget about the mic. But what I'm asking is that in this case, and if there were a stipulation, and you've seen the argument of your opposing counsel, how would that have been used?
Well, the stipulation would have automatically eliminated any potential defense that there was some innocent explanation for the touching. It's been our position all along, and I think the Court of Appeals agreed with us, that Mr. Veach did not raise the defense of accident. But I think it becomes absolutely clear that he could not have raised any such defense had his counsel proposed a stipulation. So, following sort of what Wallerman instructs on how a court should handle an offer to stipulate, the trial court should engage in a colloquy with the parties and the defendant to make sure that they understand the scope of the stipulation as well as the limits that it places on the defense. And what that would mean in this case is that he's essentially be admitting the mental state elements. Mr. Veach could not make any arguments or present any evidence on those elements. And so to say that this is a conditional stipulation, I think there's very little conditional about it. I think the only conditional aspect is that if the jury finds that there was no touching of an intimate part, then it need not even reach the mental state element. It need not reach the stipulation. However, if the jury finds that there was a touching of an intimate part, that's it. Then they have been told that the mental state elements are conclusively proven, and that's it.
So, why should the state or any other party in litigation be forced to accept a stipulation it doesn't want to enter into? It has otherwise admissible evidence. It's really good admissible evidence. So why should a court say, we force you to enter into a stipulation that disallows you from putting in the evidence, the proof that's otherwise admissible that you want to put in on the case?
And the word stipulation, I can see, causes a little confusion there, but there's nothing radical about that view either. I mean, that's indeed what the Supreme Court held in Old Chief.
But that's a very narrow decision.
It's dealing
only to a defendant's legal status as a convicted felon, and there's lots of language in the opinion to indicate that it was meant to be construed narrowly.
That's right. But I think it should be, our acceptance of these sort of forced stipulations should be, we should be more accepting of them when we're talking about other acts evidence than when we're talking about legal status. I mean, other acts evidence and legal status evidence really pose some of the same difficulties. We're talking about evidence that, by its very nature, tends to be quite prejudicial, unfairly so. We're talking about evidence that is removed from the charged offense. So the rationale that the prosecutor should be able to tell, as Old Chief talked about it, a lineal and continuous story of the charged offense, that has little application when we're talking about legal status or other acts evidence. Because, for example, in this case, the prosecutor was reaching back some 14 years before this case was tried to tell a story about a different offense involving a different child in a different place and under different circumstances.
Which in this context is highly probative.
But once you stipulate, that probative value has been drained. So now it's only prejudicial.
Well, and that brings me back to my original question, which is why should these stipulations be forced upon parties if they've got highly probative evidence that they want to get before the jury?
Because you arrive at that result by applying the existing rules of evidence in 904.04 sub 2. Because the first question you have to ask under the three-part test is it coming in for a proper purpose? And we have to now ask that in light of the alternative form of proof that's available, which is the stipulation.
Counsel, and I guess I'm referring to the trial judge's statement, which is on page 39. This, I'm looking at the red brief, the state's brief. When he says to allow and suggest that these cases, I'm talking about the Kaiser and Walderman, stand for the proposition that you can assert that no contact, occurred, and simultaneously assert that contact did not occur, occurred for a particular purpose, he says is cynical, not to mention illogical, and contrary to common sense. No one can in good conscience, I think, declare that the fact that certain conduct occurred and then did not occur at the same time. And that, so that this was the judge's comment about this particular stipulation that was at issue in this case. And I'm just asking, and I think Justice Sykes is talking about forcing the state into this position.
Well, I don't think there's anything cynical about it.
Now, those are the trial judges.
Right. What you have is a situation here where the defendant is giving up something meaningful. He's giving up his right to present evidence on the mental state elements. He's admitting those. The state no longer has to produce any evidence on those. So why should the state still, despite the stipulation, be able to come in with probably the most dangerous form of evidence we have, other acts evidence? And I mean dangerous because by its very nature it carries such a high risk of unfair prejudice.
Could I ask a question about the stipulation? You talked about stipulated purposes for the evidence being conceded. And you talked about a colloquy. How does the prosecutor use that colloquy?
I think it's the court's responsibility to conduct the colloquy, and the colloquy should be personally with the defendant to make sure that he understands that he is giving up his right to present evidence on the elements that he is admitting through his stipulation.
So what is he admitting? How does it show it's conditional? And then I think you ought to respond to, and I'd like to ask it, the question that Assistant Attorney General O'Brien raised is, how is the stipulation received and how is the jury instructed, and do you accept his instruction to the jury?
Yes, and to follow up on that, can can the prosecutor use that colloquy in a presentation to the jury?
Okay. Let me begin with how I believe the jury would be instructed on the stipulation. And I pull some of this language from our pattern instruction in existence on agreed facts, number 162. It would go like this. The district attorney and the attorney for the defendant have stipulated to the existence of certain facts, and you must accept these facts as conclusively proven. The district attorney and the defendant's attorney have stipulated to the following. If the touching of Rebecca's intimate part, her buttocks or vagina, occurred, the parties agree that the touching was intentional and for the purpose of sexual gratification. And you arrive at that sort of an instruction and stipulation by applying the existing rules of evidence. So the way I figure this is going to happen is you have a charge, first-degree sexual assault of a child. There's the mens rea element and the actus reus, the act itself. So the state has to prove that there was a touching of the child's intimate part. That's the actus reus. The state also has to prove that the touching was intentional and for the purpose of sexual gratification. That's the mens rea. So then the state would come in and say, we want to introduce other acts evidence for the purpose of proving, as they did in this case, the mental state elements to show motive, intent, absence of mistake or accident. The trial court would then conduct the three-part Sullivan analysis and determine if it is admissible. The trial court concluded here it was. At that point, defense counsel, if it's consistent with their strategy of the case, may say that we are willing to stipulate to the mental state elements. At that point, the trial court should revisit the three-step analysis and decide, now that we have this alternative method of proof, the stipulation, can the other acts evidence come in for any other proper purpose? When it can't, then the first prong of the test is not satisfied, and the court would err if it turned down the stipulation and let the state come in with the other acts evidence. And it's so consistent with the principle underlying our rule of evidence, with what we've said in Witte about how this should be used sparingly, only when reasonably necessary. Because here, when we have the stipulation and the evidence can't come in for any other proper purpose, it's not needed. The only reason it would then be coming in is for an improper purpose, which would be to bolster the complainant's credibility. This court has never said that bolstering the credibility is a proper purpose for admitting other acts evidence.
Well, could I ask a question? As part of a trial, you have the presentation of evidence by the state and by the defense. You have closing arguments, and you have instructions, and there are many other things, but I gather that during the instructions, that's what you alluded to when you started talking about. I think probably in closing argument there could be reference to these elements that have been conceded. What about during the whole time? The trial might take days to put out the evidence. What about these necessary things during the course of the trial? What can the prosecutor say about the stipulation and the colloquy during the course of the trial
Okay, I think I understand your question. These sorts of stipulations, these offers to stipulate, should be dealt with before trial. So everybody knows going in what they have to prove and what the defense can't argue. And I think it would be appropriate for the stipulation to be read to the jury at some point during the presentation of the evidence. And I think it's fair that the parties, in their opening statements, would be able to make reference to the stipulation. I mean, I think one of the advantages of what's been recognized in Wallerman and DeKaiser in this case is that we may be finding our way out of this morass in other acts evidence law, because this should help clarify for the jury what is really at issue. I mean, it seems to me this is really good trial practice. It forces both sides to know what they're going to do at trial, before trial. It forces defense counsel to really think, what is our defense here? Are we disputing, you know, the touching occurring? Are we disputing the mental state involved? And that people know going into the trial what is really at issue.
How often is the mental state in a child touching case actually disputed as a practical matter? These cases are always defended on the basis of, I didn't do it, I didn't do the touching. They're very rarely defended on the basis of, it was an accident, my hand slipped, or you know, I didn't have the improper purpose because I was bathing her, or something like that. I mean, that's not ever the case, is it?
I don't think it certainly isn't outside the realm of possibility that most. Well,
come on.
There's,
as
you know,
a practical matter, it's always, I didn't do it, she's lying, or I didn't do it, she's fantasizing and making a mistake, or whatever.
Doesn't that prove your point?
Doesn't that prove
the point you're trying to make, that the issue in the trial is not sexual, whether there was sexual gratification. The issue is whether there was an intentional touching. And that that is not for which, that is not why the evidence is being introduced.
So even if, Justice Sykes, you're right, that it's rare that the defense is that there was an innocent explanation for the touching, that state should be able to use the other acts evidence.
Well, and the reason I ask is because what you're proposing and what DeKaiser and Wallerman, in effect, in my judgment, do is eliminate the use of other acts evidence in child sexual assault cases almost entirely because of the realities of how these cases are defended. And that flies in the face of the greater latitude rule of Davidson and the long history of cases that it cited.
But you know, even Davidson in its reaffirming of the greater latitude, I thought was very clear in cautioning that even with the greater latitude rule, the other acts evidence is only going to come in if the three-part test is satisfied. So, you know, you can't really... If the other acts evidence isn't going to be able to be used as much in child sexual assault cases, I don't know that that should distress anyone who believes that the other acts evidence should be used only if the three-part test is satisfied. And I think the other thing I'd point out is that, you know, Wallerman has been around for 6 years, DeKaiser for 4 years. From the cases I see coming across my desk, other acts evidence is still being used. You know, I think there truly are cases where trial counsel is not going to stipulate.
Do you think if we affirm this Beach case, that other acts evidence will continue to be used in child sexual assault cases? Do you really believe that?
Yes, I do.
You don't think this is nothing other than a clever way of getting around Davidson and Hammer?
Well, I don't view it as a as a way to get around Davidson and Hammer.
Do you think Davidson and Hammer have any validity if we go along with Veatch and affirm Veatch? Do you think
sure.
they're going to be used in the future in any meaningful fashion?
Oh, sure.
How?
They're going to be used because they set out the framework for the three-step analysis. I mean, Davidson and Hammer didn't address this situation where there was an alternative method of proof. Those cases still remain absolutely good law in terms of how you apply the three-step analysis. But how can we say that if there's an offer to stipulate, that means that the state doesn't have to produce evidence on those elements, we're going to do the three-step analysis with a blinder on to that offer? Because if the court is willing to say that, then I think what the court is really saying is that we're going to allow other acts evidence to come in when the only purpose is to show propensity. And I really feel that if we're going to go that way, we should amend the rule. We should just set it all out there.
Well, if I'm a prosecutor, I might take great issue with what you just said and say, look, okay, you can admit that, you know, I'll go along with that stipulation, but still, I think this evidence goes in on the identity of the perpetrator or the plan. Could I get it in then?
Possibly they could. They'd certainly be getting past the first prong of the test because now it's coming in for a proper purpose, mm-hmm. right? Identity, for example. But I don't think the analysis can stop there because we've got a three-part test. The court would need to go to the second prong. And I think where the question
give me those prongs. The second prong is the balancing? Is that it?
No, that's the third prong.
Oh, that's the third prong. Okay.
The second prong is the relevancy.
Gotcha.
But I think really where it sort of coalesces here is in the third prong. If it's coming in for a proper purpose, you still have to do the balancing. And that the probative value of this evidence to show identity, it still has probative value because it's coming in for identity, but it may have less probative value than it did when it was coming in to show identity, motive, intent, absence of mistake and accident. So there may be some cases where the trial court would properly exercise its discretion and say the stipulation trumps the other act's evidence because the balance is tipped a certain way. And frankly, even the federal circuits that the state cites as having rejected the sort of stipulation have acknowledged you still have to do the balancing in light of the offer to stipulate.
Let's see if I can summarize your argument. Your argument is that under the first step in Sullivan, it doesn't go for one of the stated purposes in this case because there's an agreement on that.
Yes.
If you don't get to 2 and 3.
That's right.
The counter argument that we hear is, yeah, but then the concept of motive and intent are really very rarely or rarely in issue. And so if you can't get over the hurdle of step one, which is you don't come under the acceptable purpose under 904.042, then you are in effect not permitting other acts evidence in child sexual cases. And that's bad. Have I stated the argument as you understand?
I think that's how it's going.
All right. Your counter-argument is, what's so bad about it since 904.042 says you have limited purposes? Right?
Right.
And therefore, if you want it in when the limited purposes are not in dispute, then you really want it in for another purpose, surreptitiously. The very purpose that this statute, this rule is designed against. Right?
Yes.
Well, how are we going to convict these guys? we don't let this in. When it's the child's word against this adult's word. Well, and we know we got a bad actor, right? I don't mean your client. But generally, where you got people that have done this over and over again, and we know that there is propensity, and we also know there is recidivism, and we also know, I think, that it's very hard to change that person. Rehabilitate them.
We're going to convict the people because the state has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that the touching of the intimate part occurred. And the state should have to meet that burden of proof in every case. And it shouldn't have a lower burden because the individual has done this kind of thing before. I mean, I really want to say, I guess as I start wrapping up.
I'm just looking at the wider latitude rule that this court just adopted. How does that come in?
The greater latitude rule still is in existence. It applies at all three prongs of this test. So when the court is determining, does it come in for any proper purpose beyond what the defendant is willing to stipulate to, it's making that determination in light of the greater latitude rule. When it's doing the balancing, it has the greater latitude rule in mind as well.
Is credibility bolstering an improper purpose under 904 and 4 sub 2? I know it's not listed, but the list in 904 and 4 sub 2 is not exclusive.
It is not a proper purpose. This court has never said it is.
Well, have we said it's not?
I am not aware. Well, I think implicitly you have, because what you've said is that bolstering the credibility is a rationale for the greater latitude rule. But to be admissible, even with the greater latitude rule, it has to come in for a proper purpose. So I think the only reasonable reading of that is, I mean, if bolstering the credibility was in itself a proper purpose, we can forget about trying to fit it into these other categories because it's going to come in for that. And this court has never allowed that.
Well, why does it bolster credibility? Bolsters credibility because it says he's lying because he's done it before.
That's it. I don't know how else you would instruct the jury.
Yeah, but the propensity inference is underlying the probative value of this evidence in each of the enumerated proper purposes which have been discussed by the courts. I mean, that's the evidentiary work that this evidence does, right? I mean, if it's admitted for identity, it's because of the propensity inference makes the defendant's identification with this crime more credible, right?
And it, no, actually,
if it's admitted for motive or for intent or for purpose, it's because the fact that he did it before means he probably had the bad motive, the bad intent, and the bad purpose on this occasion as well. The same thing with identity, because if it's admitted for purposes of proving identity, it's because of the propensity inference that he's got this MO, this mode of operation, this is his fingerprint or his signature crime. He's done it before in this way, so he did it this time in this same exact way.
But
and it's the propensity inference that underlies it all.
But the difference is that it's coming in to prove a particular proper matter, which is that the touching was intentional or for the purpose of gratification. When it's for the purpose of bolstering the credibility, you have to ask, how are we going to instruct the jury as to what that means? That you should believe the child because he's done this before? Then we've done away with the rule against propensity evidence. It's just coming in for propensity. You know, and I think that the court really needs to think about where this leads us. Because if it's coming in for propensity, we are undermining our constitutional guarantees of the presumption of innocence and that the state have to prove the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. That's what underlies Witte and 90404. This idea that in this country, we try cases, not people, so that we don't haul in Mr. Veach and say, you've done X, Y, and Z before, and now they say you've done this, defend yourself. We bring people into court on a particular charge, and we make the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that offense occurred. And the only exceptions that we recognize for using the bad acts is when it's coming in for a very distinct and proper purpose.
Okay,
and I would,
we allow in all criminal cases for just to, not just, but have you ever been convicted before? How many times that comes in? Why is that there?
Oh, because it's so much more likely that this is going to be used in an unfair way when what the jury knows is that the individual has engaged in prior sexual assaults, and particularly here when the prior offenses were so much more egregious, intrusive, and aggressive than for which
what
Mr.
Beach. What the offenses are, aren't they?
Pardon?
Isn't the jury told what the offense is, the prior offense is?
Yes.
In, with the other acts evidence.
Right, but not with,
not with the other, yes.
Okay.
Thank
Counsel,
you.
Counsel, your time is up. Mr. O'Brien, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. The word propensity is one of those emotionally charged buzzwords that defense counsel often use. I think it appears several dozen times in counsel's briefs before this court. The closing arguments in this case were not recorded, but I'd be willing to bet my mortgage that the prosecutor did not get up in front of the jury and say, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, please convict Mr. Veach because he is a pedophile. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, please convict Mr. Veach because he is a bad man." Or even, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, please convict Mr. Veach because he likes kids." No, the prosecutor, I think, got up and said, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we have to prove that he touched Becky, and he did so intentionally, and he did so for purposes of his own sexual arousal or gratification. We have proved that in 1987, he was convicted of sexually assaulting his daughter, and he achieved sexual arousal or gratification in that case. That is a specific act. It is a closely related act. Whether or not Mr. Veach is a clinical pedophile is irrelevant. What is relevant is that he committed..."
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Right. I don't care whether or not he raped 10 people is irrelevant.
No, that's, if he raped 10 people, that's highly relevant. If he has a propensity to want to do that, that's not relevant.
No, what I was perhaps inappropriately engaging in was the highlighting how damaging this kind of information is. Just breathing and voicing, rather, the words, "just because he raped 10 people."
And obviously...
The witty consideration of how damaging all of this is.
Well, obviously, there's a propensity aspect, and that's why we have cautionary instructions. You are only to consider this for the element in issue. And one of the elements is, was he motivated to seek sexual gratification from this child?
Mr. O'Brien, the statutes allow this evidence in for a lot of purposes. One of those purposes is identity or plan.
Right.
So no matter how much the defendant wants to stipulate as to some elements, if in fact the prior crimes have sufficient identification, have sufficient correlation to this act, you can still get it in, right?
That's our position.
Well, why don't you, why, I mean, as I look at this case, I think maybe it was tried on a bad theory that this evidence should have gone in on the issue of identity.
Oh, no, I don't think identity was an issue here. There's no question. Everyone agrees he was with her on these occasions. The question was what his state of mind was.
Right, and this would not have been enough to prove
plan.
Identity.
What about plan?
Yeah, this was not a case where he said, "I was somewhere else," or someone else,
about,
she was...
Okay, then I misspoke. What about plan? I mean, it seems to me that a prosecutor can get this information in if there are sufficient, if there's sufficient correlation between the past acts and this.
Yes, act. I agree, and I think Davidson, as well as the earlier case in Plymesser, allow for that argument.
But you're trying to shoehorn it in to establish a motive that doesn't need to be proved.
Yes, it does need to be proved. Let's pretend we're not judges and lawyers. We're jurors. And we're sitting on Mr. Veach's jury. And the only evidence we have is Becky saying, he reached under my sleeping bag and fondled my vagina. And on the hammock, he reached under my shorts and fondled my vagina and rubbed my, I think her word was, boobs. And then Mr. Veach gets up, and the other evidence we have is Mr. Veach said, no, I didn't do that. I rubbed her in a fatherly way in the van, and I didn't touch her inappropriately and all in the hammock. Now, the defense would say, well, we've stipulated the mental state elements, so if the jury finds that the act occurred, then the mental state elements automatically kick in. No, they don't, because if you're a juror and you're assessing whether Veach touched her on her vagina or whether he did not, your natural inclination, absent any contrary evidence, is to believe that he wouldn't do that because the vast majority of adults would not have the slightest interest in doing anything like that. Therefore, there's no corroborative evidence on the credibility of her saying that the act occurred, and there's no corroborative evidence on his state of mind. And that's why the defense, this truly is a heads I win, tails you lose proposition. The defense is fighting this case so hard because they are not making a meaningful concession. It is meaningless. And the proof at trial in this case proves it. They didn't concede anything. They challenged her credibility up and down the line on whether the act occurred and on his state of mind. And therefore, I think Justice Sykes is 100% correct that if the Kiesner-Wallerman stands, other acts evidence will not be used in most child sexual assault cases, and the facts of this case prove the point because the evidence was relevant, non-prejudicial in the eyes of the Court of Appeals. Defense counsel had a strategic reason, which he articulated, for not using it even if he had known of Wallerman, and the defendant received a fair trial, and yet it was still reversed.
What you're saying is just easy to prove a case where the defendant has been previously convicted of an offense, a sexual offense with a child, then it is the first offense of that defendant. It is the first offense, it's only A versus B. Second defense, second time or third time it happens, it's A versus B, but you've got the weight of other act evidence. Isn't that your position?
Would it be easier to prove a case where there's no prior history?
It's harder to prove.
Or harder, it would be harder to prove, sure.
Sure. And so that when you do have a prior act, it's an easier one to prove, and the state wants to put in that evidence.
Just as it's easier to prove a case if the state has a confession or DNA evidence than if it doesn't. There's no difference, I don't see.
Okay, good. Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Thank you, Ms. Hagopian, for yet another other acts evidence case, which...